N,N supersymmetry, where the two ends denote the number of chiral supercharges available in a theory. So the supersymmetry algebra, that was written many times. Let me write it again. So we have some left-moving supercharges, a collection of them, which anti-commute to the translations, to the sort of holomorphic translations, combination of complex combination of the two translation operators. Some anti-chiral supercharges, which do the same with the anti-chiral translations. And then the two supercharges roughly commute. This algebra can be modified in various ways by central charges. Let me ignore that for the moment. Now, suppose I want to define a boundary condition in a theory or a general conformation one defect, and I want to preserve some amount of supersymmetry. For example, suppose that I want to put my defect at a fixed value of x2. Now, this operation clearly breaks translations. So I will lose one of the symmetry generators for translations in the presence of the defect. Now, because of that, I cannot hope to keep all the supersymmetries. Because if I have two supersymmetries which commute to the translation that I'm breaking, there will be a contradiction. So some of the supersymmetries will also have to be broken by the defect. And in general, to study the possible supersymmetric defect of a theory, the first step is to find all possible collections of supercharges which I can simultaneously preserve without producing a translation that has been broken. In this particular situation, a half BPS boundary condition would preserve something which is essentially the sum of the two chiral and anti-chiral supercharges. I mean, you can play around with these, you know, change the linear combinations of supercharges that you're pairing up, but let me just write it like that for simplicity. Let me just call this just QIs. Now, if you look at the algebra of these QIs, preserved by the boundary condition, you see that they will just anti-commute to translations along the defect. So essentially, we have the supersymmetry algebra of n equal n, sorry for the stupid notation, supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So in the presence of this boundary condition, a lot of what we learn from the supersymmetric quantum mechanics will be useful. Now, you can have boundary conditions which preserve less supersymmetry, of course, or no supersymmetry. But if you're interested in topologically twisting the theory, you want to have to preserve at least the supercharge that you use for the twisting. Now, the main examples that are of interest mathematically in the context of these boundary conditions are true comma true, where you preserve an n equal true supersymmetric quantum mechanics, at least algebra for supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and 4,4, where half BPS boundary conditions will preserve an n equal 4 algebra. And perhaps you can study also boundary conditions which preserve less supersymmetry. Say half of the maximal amount. Are there any questions? Okay, so what's the main consequence of preserving this kind of supersymmetry algebra? Is that when I study operators on my boundary, I will have available things like Q, Q dagger, maybe an R symmetry, if I had some R symmetry to start with, and it's preserved by the boundary. And in particular, when I start taking Q cohomology, this sort of data so the local operators will be some differential graded spaces, and then I have some operations of composition between local operators. We discussed in the past lectures that these are some kind of A-infinity operations, but they live in the general world of differential graded things. So roughly, boundary conditions, RPPS boundary conditions of true comma true theories, once I pass to the topological twist, will give rise to some kind of differential graded categories. There will be some differential graded category, infinity category, or whatnot, of RBPS boundary conditions. We could denote it, say, something like the brains or the boundaries of a theory tree. So, in a lot of mathematical applications of true comma true theories, the main actor is the category of boundary conditions for the theory. And I'll try to describe momentarily some examples of that. But it's also, I will also try to discuss some of these other examples, which are mathematically perhaps less well understood. For example, if I look at a 4,4 theory, if I look at quarter BPS boundary conditions, the sort of supersymmetry algebra I have available will again allow me to define some kind of DG category. We have BPS boundary conditions, will be somehow some very special elements inside this DG category that preserve more supersymmetry. And I do not know the correct mathematical way to describe, in general, how to recognize the RBPS boundary conditions inside this brain category, but at least I'll try to give some examples and wave around some words like perverse or Hodge. Words I hear whenever I look at these objects, I don't know how to use them properly, but perhaps some of the exercises will help you use these words better than me. There's another fun generalization, which is sort of orthogonal to this, and which I will not discuss further in the lecture, but I should at least mention. So here I'm discussing supersymmetric quantum field theories. The quantum field theories have interesting RG flows and behavior under scale transformations. Some of them might be scale invariant. They are called supersymmetric conformal field theories. We have not discussed conformal field theories at all until now, and we might not be able to discuss them during this cycle of lectures. But still, once your bulk theory is scale invariant, it makes sense to ask what's the behavior of the boundary of this theory under scale transformations. So you can consider standard half BPS boundary conditions. Or you can look at scale invariant. Have BPS boundary conditions. I hope that the notion is intuitively clear. The definition of scale transformation is very simple. I just take my correlation functions and I scale the distances by a lot. Right? And it should be clear that if the bulk theory is scale invariant, I can scale and apply a scale transformation. This is going to do something interesting only to the boundary operators. So, again, you can ask, what's the relation between the general category of brains and the scale invariant brains? How do I recognize inside the general category the brains which are scale invariant? Here there are a lot of fun structures which appear because I can always take a general boundary condition and apply a G-flow to it and keep a G-flowing until it hits something scale invariant. And then if I just look at a very large amount of a G-flow but not infinite, I'll find some small deformation of a scale invariant boundary condition. So this story is all about the fact that boundary conditions here admit some kind of a canonical decompositions into objects here. And there are notions like stability which emerge. And again, I'm not sure that the proper discussion of the physical relation of conformal symmetry and stability have been discussed beyond intuitive explanations. So these are sort of two different contexts in which it becomes interesting to look at some subcategories of your category. Usually, right, what happens is that when I live here, I can do a lot of interesting operations. There are a lot of ways to put together objects into new objects and deform them to get even more objects. A lot of these operations are not compatible with scale invariance, for example, or with any conformal supersymmetry. Anyway. It's a nice piece of extra structure. Now, part of the reason you might want to study these sub collections is that often dualities preserve these extra structures. For example, most of the examples of category boundary conditions which are relevant for geometric Langlands or for symplectic duality are associated with theories with 4,4 supersymmetry. And so inside those big categories, there are special collections or special objects. There are nice collections of special objects. And the property of being half BPS is typically preserved by dualities. So maybe in your studying two dual categories, and inside there must be two subcollections which are matched under duality. And often for this, because you have more supersymmetry, you might have better computational ability within these subcollections. Yes. So, I think it will be important to understand this relation better. I think so, but I cannot prove it to you. So the whole theory of stability condition should be something which can be derived just looking at scaling variant Chukwumachu theories. Mm-hmm.
There's in examples that we know, there's some T-structures, that objects in the heart of that T-structure are...
Yes, I think so. That's right. So often, one of the operations you cannot do in these restricted worlds is to shift the degree of an object. I think this statement should be related to what you said, but again, I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable. That's right. Not at all. Except that in both situations you have extra supersymmetries. Because the scale invariance actually comes with an enhancement of the whole supersymmetry algebra, that's something called superconformal symmetries. So, right, perhaps there is a general theory on how these structures appear when you have an extra supersymmetry in your theory. Or maybe there are just a lot of these structures which have no physical meaning and some special ones that are associated to other superconformal and equal form. I don't know. Okay. So. Now, there are two ways. Some of the quantum mechanics, supersymmetric quantum mechanics algebra plays a role in study boundary conditions. One, as I mentioned, is that the local operators on boundary conditions have an action of Q and Q dagger just in the same way as in the quantum operators of the quantum mechanics. There is another context, though, which is important, which is that once you have boundary conditions, you can study your two-dimensional theory on a strip. Now, there are some interesting subtleties in comparing. See, to define a strip, you need a boundary on the left and a boundary on the right. And there are interesting subtleties on in which sense giving a boundary condition allows me to put the boundary condition to the left or to the right. So speaking, when your theory is framed, left boundary conditions and right boundary conditions are somewhat different, and then there is a sort of rotation functor which relates them. I'm going to ignore these subtleties for now. Maybe I'll come back to them later if I have time. But for now, I just want to say that once you give me two boundary conditions, I can produce a physical theory on R times 0,1. And this physical theory will effectively be a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. A sufficiently low energy. This strip has a length scale. So the correct statement is that if your energies are much lower than the scale set by this length, this is well approximated by a quantum mechanical, finite dimensional quantum mechanical system. At finite L, it's more like some kind of a quantum mechanics with an infinitely many degrees of freedom, which are the sort of the Fourier modes or the fields expanded along the strip. But anyway, you get some kind of a this sort of space of states that you can associate to the two brains, again, will be a nice differential graded complex. And there are relations called state operator map between the space of states on a strip and the space of local operators on a boundary condition. I will not write it as inequality because of the subtleties with framing, but they can be explained. So there are these differential graded vector spaces, which you can both study as spaces of states or as states or spaces of local operators. Let me call this the rotation by minus pi of boundary 2. There is also a relation to a configuration where b1 in the past and, b, and the rotation by pi of b2 is in the future. Anyway, this is just to say that right, a lot of the technology you learn in quantum, in supersymmetric quantum mechanics can be applied to studying local operators in two different ways. One, you can say that local operators behave like local operators in the quantum mechanics, but more usefully, the local operators really behave like the states of a quantum mechanics.
And the state operator corresponds to choosing a link. Is there a link here?
Link, sorry?
So here you're working on a half space on the right with a point on the boundary. The link of that point is a feature map.
Yes, you're right. So state operator map sort of has to do with foliating your space time like this. Versus foliating it like that. So in a scale invariant theory, this is a rigorous statement about the physical local operators and physical states of the theory. In a non-scale invariant theory, it's more subtle. But in a topological theory, it becomes true again. Although, if it depends on the framing, you might need to account for the fact that you're clearly using a different framing than the naive one, which would have looked like that. But this is just to give an extra motivation to the fact that I'm going to spend a nice chunk of the lecture discussing once again n equal 2 supersymmetric quantum mechanics and n equal 4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics. This at least will be new. So this construction, which associates two pairs of brains a nice vector space, is very useful. So it's very useful because it sort of gives a natural way to probe. If you have a lot of a certain convenient family of boundary conditions available to you, you can use it to probe the properties of other boundary conditions by pairing them up. Let me give the canonical example. Let's take the B model. So I'm not going to discuss immediately the most general boundary conditions for the B model, but I want to just tell you that there is one nice class of boundary conditions called Dirichlet boundary conditions. Dirichlet boundary conditions called NDP are defined, among other things, by requiring the fields, the value of the fields at the boundary to assume some fixed value. So if you think about, so in the classical theory, right, the solutions, you're looking at solutions to the equations of motion such that the fields, you know, maps into the target space, which go to a point at the boundary. So these Dirichlet boundary conditions are labeled by a point on your manifold. We will discuss later on what are sort of the local operators you can find on Dirichlet boundary conditions. Intuitively, you might expect at the very least to have something which lives in the tangent bundle to something. But anyway, there will be surely operators that allow you to deform this boundary condition a little bit by moving the point around, for example. But the main observation that I need is that if I have a generic boundary condition in some theory, in some B model on X, okay, don't write anything, and I put Dirichlet boundary conditions here, this gives me some quantum mechanical system with an equal two supersymmetry, which depends on the point, on the choice of point, and of course on the boundary condition. And it depends holomorphically, in the sense that Matt was discussing in some of the previous lectures. So formally, the supercharge inside this quantum mechanics is holomorphic. So if you give me any boundary condition, I get for free a family, a holomorphic family, of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, parametrized by the manifold, by the target. So this is a nice map, right? It started something that was one-dimensional defects in a two-dimensional theory and spits out one-dimensional theories which sort of can talk to the two-dimensional theory.
Mm-hmm.
For now, I'm keeping the length of the interval fixed. So it's true, this quantum mechanics will depend also on the length. So for every length, really, I'll get a family of such quantum mechanics.
Where is X?
X is the bimodal on X, sorry. My bad. That I wrote it. But you can convince yourself that the quantum mechanics for different L are, in a sense, quasi-isomorphic.
Is it only holomorphic after taking U cohomology?
Good point, sorry. No, I don't think so. I think it's holomorphic on the nose. Pretty much because moving around P can be done by this scent relation. So if I want to go from P to P plus delta, I can do it by adding a term to the Lagrangian, to the boundary Lagrangian, which is the descendant of some specific field. And so when I do these sort of deformations, the supercharge changes by delta. So Q is deformed by delta, Q dagger is deformed by something proportional to delta dagger. I mean, this is actually something I came back to. But perhaps I can discuss now. So suppose I have a deformation of a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We saw that as long as I'm okay with deforming the Hamiltonian, I have a deformation as soon as Q, infinitesimal deformation for now, or even finite, doesn't really matter. So my deformation X has to anticommute Q infinitesimally, and X dagger has to commute with Q dagger. Now, it's a nice fact that I can take my deformation and multiply it by any complex number. And I still get a good deformation. This is very special of n equal true supersymmetric quantum mechanics. I mean, it looks completely unremarkable here, but it becomes a little bit more interesting if you think in terms of the real components of the supercharges. So we had a in terms of the real components, we had the superalgebra which looks like that, and we're looking for deformations which satisfy an equation like this. So in the case where in the case where n equal to 2, this means that the anticommutator of Q and X is something proportional to delta ij plus something proportional to the antisymmetric tensor. See, this is a, once you go to complex coordinates, both these and these are off-diagonal matrices. I mean, sorry, when I say this properly. Right, let me just say it like that. You can look at linear combinations of these old X's to produce new X's which satisfy the same equation. Possibly with the delta H and W mixed up together. And for n equal to 2, you can do it. You write just X is equal to X1 plus IX2. And we saw we can multiply it. Then delta X for a complex delta is still a good deformation. And notice that this, if I decompose this into a real and imaginary part, this looks like x1 delta 1 plus x2 delta minus x2 delta 2 plus I x1 delta 2 plus x2 delta 1. So it's special to n equal 2 that we can take the two components of the deformation and mix them up in a way that gives me another valid deformation. And that's why deformations of an n equal 2 quantum mechanics are naturally complex. With the caveat I'll come back to later. If I try to solve the same problem for n equal 4, it's much more complicated. And I'll discuss later in the lecture how do the formations of an n equal 4 quantum mechanics look like. Okay, so coming back here, yes, the fact that this is a holomorphic family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics is pretty much automatic by the fact that it's the deformation of n equal 2, the formation family of unequal true quantum mechanics. It comes for free. After a caveat that I'll discuss in a moment, that sometimes instead of complex deformations, you can sort of get real flat deformations. But I'll discuss it later.
So you take the B model on X, you fix a boundary condition B.
Yes.
And the derivative boundary condition, you get a simple.
Yes. And notice when you say I fix a boundary condition B, yeah. I'm making no assumption about it.
Yes.
I'm not assuming, for example, that I can describe it in a weakly coupled way. This is a, even if the B model was described perturbatively with coupling, this could be a strongly coupled boundary condition for that B model. It's perfectly possible to have very interesting, interactive boundary conditions for even for free theories.
Mm-hmm. When you say holomorphic family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, does that mean the Hilbert space of the theory varies holomorphic in some?
Well, it's a Hilbert space, so I don't think I even need to vary it. That's right.
At certain points, the rank of that Hilbert space will jump from like whatever it is to zero.
It's because you decided to work with a finite dimensional Hilbert space.
Ah, okay.
But this thing is going to give me a huge infinite dimensional Hilbert space.
Yes.
Because it's really the quantization of a phase space, and the phase space is pretty much a space of maps from the segment into X with certain boundary conditions, so it's huge. Now, this operation that goes from boundary conditions to quantum mechanics has kind of an inverse. So there are other boundary conditions which are given in the B model, which are called enriched Neumann. Let me start with Neumann. So Neumann boundary conditions are defined kind of in the opposite way as Dirichlet. Instead of fixing the boundary value of phi, you leave phi at the boundary free to fluctuate. Instead, you put a constraint on some of the other fermionic fields in the theory. And also, you get something like the normal derivative of phi at the boundary equals to zero. And other stuff. I'm not going to describe the full boundary condition to you, but you can derive it easily with the technology that you have learned from Dillon talks and from today's lecture. Now, once you have this boundary condition, you can modify it. You can sort of stack on top of it your supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So suppose you have given a supersymmetric quantum mechanics as a family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics parametrized by X. I don't know what would be a good symbol of a family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics parametrized by X. At the moment I'm just gonna put an arrow from X to supersymmetric quantum mechanics, but I'm sure this could be done better notationally. Anyway, I can sort of place the quantum mechanics along this line and couple it to the bulk fields just by identifying the parameters with the boundary value of the bulk field. So in terms of an action, you can imagine that you're taking the action for the bulk theory with the usual with the Neumann boundary conditions, and deforming it by the action of the quantum mechanics, where whatever parameter has been identified with the boundary value of the bulk fields. So you take this action functional, you do a variation of it, you can get the full boundary condition, equation of motion, and so on. For example, you discover that the right-hand side of this equation is modified in a certain way. Now, crucially, this gives you a map from supersymmetric quantum mechanics parametrized by holomorphical by X and boundary conditions. So we can go both ways now. We can go from, so in a sense, this gives you a precise notion today of boundary degrees of freedom. It says there is an operation which can detach, kill the bulk and leave you with some one-dimensional theory. And there's another operation which can take a one-dimensional theory with correct hooks and attach it to a bulk. And these operations are roughly inverse of each other. Well, I say roughly because, in a sense, if you try to attach this to Neumann, what you're producing is the original boundary condition, but placed farther by an amount L. But at least morally speaking, so this gives you kind of two functors, in a sense, which are inverse up to homotopy. Up to an appropriate homotopy, I would say yes. At least this gives you a very good motivation to believe that the boundary conditions of the B model will be parametrized by the same category which describes supersymmetric quantum mechanics parametrized by X. And now we can try to study the purely one-dimensional problem of trying to extract a further mathematical object out of this supersymmetric quantum mechanics parametrized by X. So I sort of decomposed the problem of identifying boundary conditions into two subproblems. One was quite physical, of relating them to quantum mechanics, and the other is more mathematical, which is to find a mathematical object which encodes this family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Any questions?
And if you weren't assuming any of the X properties right now, and you're expecting that those will give you some special properties?
Well, these were half BPS. Otherwise, I would not get n equals 2 supersymmetric quantum mechanics. That's right. If I was in n equals 4 theory, and I was looking for half BPS, well, it just so happened that the Dirichlet boundary condition is half BPS. So this picture will give me an n equal, if this is also a BPS, this picture will give me an n equal 4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so immediately I would learn that in order to study n equal 4 supersymmetric, half BPS boundary conditions, I need to understand n equal 4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics within n equal 2 supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And I will do that at the end of the lecture. So
you said you mentioned putting a supersymmetric quantum mechanics on top of it.
Yes.
What, can you say more about that?
So I mean that you're taking a combined system, the bare Neumann boundary condition and the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, just put them together.
But it can be any supersymmetric.
Any supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Then if the supersymmetric quantum mechanics has a holomorphic parameter which lives on X, you can tie them together by replacing it with the boundary value of the field. I mean, this is a general strategy in the sense that the simplest way to define a defect is to have to add some extra degrees of freedom with an action which depends on the defect values of the bulk fields. From the point of view of Dillon's lecture, if this quantum mechanics was the quantization of a phase space, then you could use this phase space to build a Lagrangian in T star shifted by 1 of X, which defines enriched Neumann. Here, I'm not assuming the existence of such a phase space. As I said, I don't want to assume that anything is weakly coupled. But the moral construction is the same. So, So back to quantum mechanics. Actually, let me just do general n for a moment, and then I specialize to 2, and then to 4. So there are some universal statements that I can make. So this quantum mechanics will, in general, have some spectrum. Right? I'll be able to organize my Hilbert space into eigenspaces for my Hamiltonian, which is a nice, in physical situations, is a nice self-adjoint operator. Now, suppose that I'm looking at the part of the spectrum where the energy, which is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian, is positive. Right? Suppose I take a subspace of the Hilbert space, HE, where the Hamiltonian equals E, and is positive. Okay? Well, then this is essentially a Clifford algebra. So the non-zero energy states will come into representations of, into modules of the Clifford algebra, which are nice big objects if n is large. On the other hand, the ground states do not. In a unitary theory, the ground states will just be killed by all supercharges. In a unitary theory, it's a little bit messier, but in a non-unitary theory, but in a unitary theory, there is really a very nice sharp distinction. Ground states, which are also going to be what's relevant to the Q cohomologies, are just a vector space. On the other hand, the non-zero energy states are Clifford modules. If I vary my quantum mechanics in a family, the ground states then cannot jump in a generic way. They can only jump by multiples of a Clifford module. So if I think about the if I have a family of quantum mechanics and I think about the cohomology of that quantum mechanics or the ground state of the quantum mechanics as some kind of a sheaf, you see that as I increase n, the ways this sheaf can jump, the fiber, the stock of the sheaf can jump, will be increasingly constrained.
So
if you change
E, if you fix an E, then just the energy E eigenstates forming Clifford modules.
That's right.
Is this theory necessarily gapped?
Well, in a well-behaved quantum mechanics, the spectrum is discrete. In a sufficiently well-behaved quantum mechanics. In particular, when the quantum mechanics which comes by studying a good quantum field theory on a strip are just have a discrete spectrum. Sometimes the spectrum, now it's perfectly possible to study situations where the theory is a little bit less well-behaved, like a B-model or non-compact target, in which case, indeed, there might be a continuum, and you want the continuum to really stay above zero, to have a gap. And it's true that if the continuum touches zero, then you might have more complicated, more subtle jumps.
So we're not going to study a quantum mechanics suitable for electron bands.
Hmm? Well, I mean, if you put things in a box, things are.
What's the statement about the E energy zero states?
So I'm just saying the zero energy states are just killed by all the supercharges, and there is no extra structure.
Okay.
Instead, the non-zero energy states had to come into multiplets where the supercharges act in a non-trivial way. So for n equal to 2, for example, you would always have non-zero energy states coming in pairs where the supercharge moves you one way and the other supercharge moves you the other way. And then the zero energy states would be annihilated by both. So okay. So when you deform your Hamiltonian, your non-zero energy states will move up and down in energy. But as long as they don't come all the way down, they don't change your cohomology, of course. And it's easy to write homotopies. So the cohomology of the, you know, the ground states of the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which are related by deformations, which don't bring any, which don't close the gap between the first excited states and the ground states, will be homotopy equivalent. Right, so now suppose we have a family of quantum of n equal 2 quantum mechanics parametrized by x. Let's pick a point in X and look at the quantum mechanics there. Now, so given the quantum mechanics, there is a natural operation which is sort of cut the quantum mechanics, cut this, the Hilbert space to the part whose energy is smaller than some amount. So if you give me any cutoff lambda, I can take a projection on energy smaller than lambda or the Hilbert space. This would be a nice finite dimensional vector space. It will still have supercharges acting on it and so on. And it will be essentially equivalent to the original space from the point, you know, if your objective is to study the ground states. Furthermore, if you deform your point a little bit, if you explore the neighborhood of the point, okay, your states will move up and down a bit, but at least for a while, you can imagine that no state will pass, will come in or out. So the same vector space can be used to describe this whole family of quantum mechanics around the point, at least on an open neighborhood. If I had two different neighborhoods which overlap, well, I can always embed both spaces into the Hilbert space cut off at some higher energy. And so write down an explicit quasi-isomorphism between them. So pretty much by just this cut-off procedure, which you can think of as sort of writing down a low energy effective quantum mechanics for your system, you can get a bunch of effective finite dimensional descriptions, each valid in some open patch of your manifold. So you can map your big family of infinite dimensional supersymmetric quantum mechanics to a collection of finite patches, each with a finite dimensional quantum mechanics on it. So these are essentially a collection of, in each open set I have a chain complex. When open sets overlap, I have some quasi-isomorphism of the chain complexes, and these quasi-isomorphisms are all compatible with each other. I'm told that this is a quasi-coherent sheaf. on X. Vice versa, if somebody gives me this kind of data of a collection of auxiliary Hilbert vector spaces on each open set, I assume I can presumably just build a gigantic Hilbert space in which all of them can sit and try to build up backwards the quantum mechanics which covers the whole family. I'm not sure about this last step. I think it would be a nice exercise to see if this is actually true. But it's definitely a map from families of supersymmetric quantum mechanics parameterized by X and quasi-coherent shifts. And I believe this is this can be inverted. So this could be a way to arrive to the statement that quasi-coherent shifts are the category of boundary conditions in the B model. See, in a sense, to identify the category of boundary conditions of the B model with quasi-coherent shifts, you need to do three things. First, you need to make sure that to every boundary condition you can associate a quasi-coherent shift. Then you need some way backwards to build a boundary condition given a quasi-coherent shift. And that essentially means build up an auxiliary quantum mechanics, which sort of covers the whole collection, and then couple it in rich Neumann boundary conditions. And then the third step is to make sure that you don't just have a map between objects, but you can also relate morphisms. So for example, a local operator in order to do that, you probably want to use structures like this. So if you take the space of states on a strip, you local operators on the boundaries become operators in the quantum mechanics. They act on the Hilbert space on the strip. So you can see sort of a representation of the operators of B and the operators of your Dirichlet boundary into operators of the supersymmetric quantum mechanics associated to this pair. These actions morally commute because if I have an operator here and an operator here, there is clearly an homotopy which allows me to bring it here. So there are sort of commuting up to homotopy actions of these two. Depending on how you want to formalize your algebra local operators, this can take different forms. For example, in the infinity world, this would be the statement that this vector space is an A infinity bimodule for the algebra local operators on this. And algebra local operators on this. So this allows in particular to map the local operators on this boundary condition to operators acting in this quantum mechanics, which commute with this. And now, if you can then find a correspondence between operators in the quantum mechanics and endomorphisms of a quasi-coherent shift, then you would get what we want. You would get to a relation between. So what we need essentially is a relation between local operators in the quantum mechanics which commute with this action and endomorphisms of your quasi-coherent shift and vice versa. So that would complete the proof that there is really a functor between quasi-coherent shifts and boundary conditions for the B model on X. I mean, not really. No. I'm thinking about all local operators with the differential given by the supercharge. So here, I would probably want to pass to the infinity, to the low energy effective A infinity structure at the very least. But I think this is, you know, this is a quasi-isomorphism of differential graded algebra, presumably. Differential graded categories. Let's see, what time is it? Okay. Now, presumably similar constructions should be available whenever you have, whenever somebody tells you that the boundary conditions of some topological twisted theory have a specific mathematical description. So for example, if you have a superpotential, I assume you can do a similar analysis to end up with matrix factorizations. Or if you study the A model, you can do a similar analysis to make contact with whatever you want to use to describe A brains. Now, there are more things I could discuss about this. There are a lot of fun little calculations you can do to really understand, for example, what are the local operators on the Riclet boundary conditions, how do they act, you know, what is this bimodal structure, and so on. It's a lot of fun, but I don't think, I think you understand those things better than me, actually, and trying to explain them would not be a great idea. Now, for example, you can ask, you know, how does algebra of local operators on the Dirichlet boundary condition behave when you change local coordinates on your manifold X? And you can find a very nice quasi-isomorphism whose structure constants are literally the Taylor expansion of your coordinate change, and so on and so forth. So you can really see that, for example, having this action of the Dirichlet boundary conditions somehow tell you that you have an operator in the quantum mechanics which can be extended to a family of operators in a neighborhood, and so on. Anyway, I would like to move to N equal 4. Notice I did not make any statements about R symmetry. So everything I was doing was C2 graded, but the most interesting situations are often Z graded, and as we saw in the previous lecture, the situation is typically that you have an R symmetry, you have a U1 global symmetry in the bulk theory, which acts on the supercharges in some way, and you consider boundary conditions which preserve that symmetry. And so you obtain quantum mechanics with a U1 symmetry that gives you the gradient. Similarly, now that I'm discussing the N equal 4, I should discuss really also the possible R symmetries of that. I don't know if I'll have time to do so. But I'll try. Now, what can I say about N equal to 4? Well, for example, first of all, because the Lyapunov of, I mean, it's natural in the same way as in N equal true, we decompose the, we recombine the supercharges into some complex combination Q and Q dagger, which is nice to work with. Here we can try to reorganize the four supercharges a little bit. A convenient thing is to replace a vector to organize them as matrices, essentially, in the same way as C was doing for the coordinates in R4. So you can have some matrix Q AA dot, where both A and A dot run from 1 to 2. So concretely, the elements of this matrix would be something like Q1, plus IQ2, Q Q1 minus IQ2, Q3 plus IQ4, sorry, minus Q1 plus IQ2, and Q3 minus IQ4, I think. I didn't double check, but I think that's it. And then the supersymmetry algebra becomes QAA dot QBB dot equal to epsilon AB, epsilon A dot B dot H. There are four supercharges. I'm still describing a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. There is only one Hamiltonian.
Right.
In principle, you could have up to SO4 asymmetry rotating the four supercharges. And then that SO4 is really can be decomposed as, can be seen as SU2 times SU2. And then it would be SD2, SU2 would be acting separately on these two. Okay. Now, let me study the deformations of this. An infinitesimal deformation will be given by a quadruple of operators. With anticommutators must have a very restricted form. So the symmetric part should be only given by variation of the Hamiltonian. The antisymmetric part is a priori free. So these are sort of symmetric tensors, and these are the epsilon, the antisymmetric tensors. Now, so this is the most general deformation of an equal force supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And this kind of very general deformation only comes in real families, a priori. I don't know of any way to sort of rejuggling these four elements in order to give me another deformation, which is the complexified partner of this real direction. But there are two types of spatial deformations. Which can occur. So a spatial deformation is one for which either this vanishes, so this is the first type of spatial deformation. And the second spatial deformation is deformation for which this one vanishes. What's special about them? Well, suppose that I have a solution of the equation QA dot XBB dot equal to what was I using here? Epsilon A dot B dot Epsilon AB delta H plus WAB. Then the same equation will also be satisfied by linear combinations of the axes of this form, where I rejiggle the first index. right? This will mix the Hamiltonian with this other quantity. So this will be different deformations, the chain, different deformation of the same quantum mechanics. But they will be somehow partners of the original deformation. Now, I really want this guy to be real, satisfy some reality condition. So you might wonder if this can be done compatible with the reality condition. And the answer is yes. So I find it useful to describe it as follows. So so let me call this sort of y b dot b, b b dot. So suppose I write y plus plus dot as u x plus plus dot plus v x plus minus dot. The reason I'm focusing on this particular element is that whenever we twist later on the quantum mechanics, we'll have to pick an Hilbertian supercharge. And if you look at the commutation relations, you can see that if I take, say, q plus plus, that's going to be an Hilbertian. So this will be an example of an Hilbertian supercharge, of a deformation of the Hilbertian supercharge. Now, starting from something like this, you can find expressions for all the other. Sorry, I was supposed to be acting on this index. My bad. So I do something like that, and then it turns out that the complex conjugates also work. So essentially, the reality condition is preserved if this matrix take a form like UV minus U bar U bar. So here I'll write something like Y minus plus dot equal V bar minus V bar X plus plus dot plus U bar X minus plus dot and y plus, sorry, minus minus dot is the same. Okay. So no, it's not a redefinition. I want to illustrate the following fact. In the n equal 2 case, a generic deformation was automatically holomorphic, which really means that if you give me any real deformation of an n equal 2 quantum mechanics, I can find a second deformation so that the topological supercharge depends holomorphically on the complex combination of these two. I want to find the analog of that. And for a general deformation, I cannot. So this n equal 4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics will have some real deformations which have no nice complexification. Nothing to do. But some of the deformations are nice. And I have the property that if I have one real deformation, I get for free three more real deformations. So that locally. So locally, these are described by two complex coordinates, two complex deformation parameters, which I called u and v. Somehow, I should not really think about it as just R4 seen as C2. It's more interesting than that, because if you take any linear combinations, something like y plus a dot plus zeta y minus a dot, and you rewrite it in terms of x, you will find things like u minus zeta v bar. I'm not going to write it, but I just want to say that depending on which supercharge you think as topological, this four-dimensional space will be equipped with a whole CP1 worth of complex structures, where u plus zeta v bar minus zeta v bar and v plus zeta u bar are local coordinates. In the deformation space. We call them u zeta and v zeta, such that del u zeta bar of q zeta, say, plus dot is zero. And the v bar zeta q zeta dot plus dot is zero. So the deformation spaces that correspond to this kind of deformations look like hyperholomorphic manifolds, manifolds which have sort of a whole CP1 worth of complex structures. And depending on which particularly potent supercharge I want to use to twist my setup, I will think about them as complex manifolds in a specific complex structure. So the special deformations are kind of hyperholomorphic. So we see already sort of two interesting pieces of structure. The first is that the deformation spaces of this quantum mechanics are not just complex manifolds, but have more structure. And the second is that, as I mentioned, the cohomology of this quantum mechanics will jump by Clif 4 modules instead of jumping by Clif 2 modules, as in the Nicole Chu case. So so whatever sheaves I obtain over these hyperholomorphic manifolds will satisfy some more stringent constraints on how the fiber can jump. Now, more precise statements will require specifying which R symmetry does the theory has. Am I happy with just having a U1 R symmetry and not to have a Z grading? No R symmetry at all? A Z2 grading, or maybe an SU2 R symmetry, so that maybe rotating these dotted indices. In most physical situations, there will be an SU2 R symmetry rotating these dotted indices, which essentially means that it doesn't really matter which. You know, if I look at Q plus dot or minus dot or some inner combination of those are all equivalent because they are related by a symmetry. On the other hand, different choices of zeta. I'm not sure I wrote it. Will matter. Now, before I continue, I should give you some examples of N equal 4 quantum mechanics. But I should stress that these sort of structures will be there in the home spaces between half BPS boundary conditions in N equal 4 theory. Okay, so right. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the first example is the is to take the n equal true, the RAM supersymmetric quantum mechanics, the one where you have some manifold M, some maps from R to M, right, with some extra fermionic stuff, such that the supercharges were the and the dagger acting on forms. Now, suppose now I take my manifold to be actually a Kähler. Then something nice happens. I can decompose my D into Hodge, into so I have four nice operators I can use. The holomorphic del, the del bar, and their adjoints. So this becomes something you could call the Hodge supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Associated to any Kähler manifold. This theory has a nice asymmetry, actually. Sorry, I was supposed to put here, which is called the Lesch's action, which allows you to sort of relate del bar and del dagger and del and del bar dagger, as far as I remember. So what are the, how much of the structure we were discussing can we see here? Well, for example, let's study the possible families on important supercharges. They would look like del plus zeta del bar. So it's sort of there is a nice CP1 work of choices, where at the North Pole I have del bar. Maybe I should put the bar here. At the South Pole I have del, and at intermediate locations I have something which, you know, it's one, I have the sum of del and del bar. And at the generic points, I have some funny linear combinations of del and del bar. So generically, as far as I understand, the cohomology is pretty much the same as the cohomology of the Dirac differential. But at these special locations, I get Talbot cohomology, or its conjugate. Now, can I say? In this example, it's not terribly easy to see good examples of of trihalomorphic deformations. I'll come back to it. I just want to present two examples of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So this is one. Now, the other example is a trihalomorphic version Dolbo. Quantum mechanics. So remember in the n equal 2 case, the superchargers were the Dalbar operator twisted by a connection on some bundle, holomorphic bundle, and its conjugate. Now suppose that your manifold, so I had a Kähler, at least a complex space X, and a holomorphic bundle E with connection I used in the Dalbar operator. Now, to make an n equals 4 version of that, I can take X to be hyperkähler. And I can look for a bundle with a connection A, which is holomorphic in all complex structures. Concretely, that means the curvature of A, the 1-1 part of the curvature in any complex structure, the curvature is of type 1-1 in all complex structures. This is called the hyperholomorphic bundle. Then you can show that you can decompose. You can consider the Dalbar operator in complex structure zeta, and you can show that it is really a linear combination of two differential operators, and so is for the Hermitian conjugate. It's a bit messy to show it, but at least I know how to do it in local coordinates, but it's ugly. But it's true. So this defines an n equal 4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And in this situation, it's very easy to find the kind of hyper-complex deformation spaces I was discussing. For example, you can take a family of hyperholomorphic bundles. And I want to give a very concrete example of that. So, I mean, the example will be worked out in the exercises, but let me mention it because I'm out of time. So you can take your X to be C2, and then hyperholomorphic is the same as being an instanton. And so you can define a quantum mechanics for an instanton bundle on C2.
You
I don't remember, sorry. It might be automatic, I'm not sure. Okay, so this is all I have time to say now. So there are nice examples of n equal 4 quantum mechanics. And if you study them, you might get concrete examples of the sort of restrictions that we expect to see, which characterize n equal 2 bundles of n equal 4 quantum mechanics as opposed to bundles of n equal 2 quantum mechanics. So in the exercises, actually, you're not going to define this quantum mechanics. We're going to find the exercises are going to discuss something else. You're going to discuss a family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics called the ADHM, a finite-dimensional ADHM quantum, finite-dimensional hyperspaces, parametrized by C2. And for which the ground states are the instanton bundle on C2. And perhaps there you can already see some aspects of the restrictions on degree shifts, or perhaps some perversity in the coherent shifts. OK, I think I'm done for today. Any more questions?